So, welcome. I am working as a physicist doing research at the Research Institute of Physics in Slovak capital called Bratislava, which is actually not far from Vienna. It is down the Danube, only 55 kilometers. So it's to be here in Sopron, it's, I feel like at home, being at home, actually. I'm working in this field of theoretical physics more than 35 years, and being a Christian, I always try to see how my scientific work relates to my Christian faith. And knowing that the Lord has revealed something of himself in several ways, one of them is his revelation through the nature. And observing the wonders of nature, people can grasp that there is somebody behind. So the nature is one way of his revelation. The other revelation is given through the revelation of Jesus Christ and revelation through prophets, the Old Testament prophets, and culmination in Jesus Christ. So if those two revelations come from the same person, then there should not be contradictions between what we see in the nature and what we read in the scriptures. Yet, I was raised up in atheistic country, which was governed by the very strong communist leadership. We were told that that science has proved that there is no God, and that to believe in God, actually it means to believe something of the Middle Ages darkness and fairy tales, you know, something which is not real. So for me, it was always very, very interesting to know, did really science has proved that God doesn't exist, or can we see from the science something of the wonders and of the nature of God? There are several topics which we could talk about, but I have decided to confine my talk to you on these few. The whole lecture I gave the title, The Myth of Atheism. The reason is because the atheist has claimed that we as Christians, we believe in myth. And so I was trying to see whether I am misguided if I take the Bible seriously, because it is a mystical, non-realistic, and false, or if I am right with my approach to God and my understanding of God, then there is no other way, only that the atheistic views must be wrong. And studying and seeing, trying to see what the Marxism and atheism is based on actually was the best way to see the weaknesses of the Marxistic and atheistic approach. In the country, we were forced to study Marxism and Leninism and even Engels before Marx and all the other materialistic thinkers. And we were compulsory. It was compulsory for us to attend those lectures. And so I found that the best way for Christians to defend their Christian faith was actually to study the faith of the opponents. Because, as I will show you, the materialistic worldview is based really on mystical claims, which the modern science doesn't support. So these are the few myths which the atheists claim. One of them is that matter is eternal. The other one, universe is eternal, being made of matter and energy, then also universe is eternal. And it was only 40 years ago when I remember that it was the sound, a scientific claim, the only scientific claim within our educational system, that universe is eternal. It can change, it can somehow change the forms, but it is from minus infinity to plus infinity. There is no creation. The other myth is that many people believe that science is all-powerful, is omnipotent, that the science can explain everything, and that so we will go through that argument as well. And the final one is that the science has proved that there is no God. So let us have the closer look at those claims. The atheistic claim was that Christians believe in myth because they believe that nothing exists except matter and energy. And I added there a space and time, but according to the general theory of relativity of Einstein, which is accepted scientific, nowadays very, very well accepted theory, even the space and time are only the reflection of the existence of matter and energy. So the space and time by themselves are not the basic entity of the existence. This is only the matter and energy. So let us have a look together why they believe this, that except matter and energy, there is nothing else. I think we need to go back to the 18th century when the French scientist Lavoisier has done his experiments, and he was measuring the weight of chemical ingredients before the reaction, and then the reaction was turned on by some burning. And for instance, a coal, if you have a coal and the coal starts to burn, then if you measure the weight of the coal, and if you measure at the end the weight of the ashes and the weight of the carbon dioxide, that nothing escapes, then you find out that the same amount of mass which was before the reaction, you have there also after the reaction. So that measurement, and it was repeated many times, caused scientists to formulate it in a form of a law of a matter conservation, and similar law was postulated about the energy, because also energy can change the form, but if you have some energy at the beginning and you change it to heat and to electricity, for instance, and to electric current, then if you count out all the energies, then what you have at the end should be the same as what you had at the beginning. There were actually two separate laws, the law of conservation of matter and the law of conservation of energy. Only later on, when Albert Einstein was doing his theoretical considerations about space and time, he came to the conclusion that matter and energy are intimately connected, and he formulated his famous equation E equals mc square, where E is the energy, m is the matter, which is changed to the energy form, and c is the velocity of light. So if we have some matter, and if we are able to change it to energy, then this is the amount of energy we get. And if, on the contrary, if we have energy, and if in some way we could change energy to the matter, then this is this amount m is what we get out from this energy equal E. And so this discovery actually has shown that it is possible that matter can be changed to energy, theoretically, and energy can be changed to matter. But there were no very much scientific proofs of such processes. It was just pure speculation. But it caused the fact, it caused scientists to reformulate those two laws, the laws of conservation of matter and law of conservation of energy, into one law, saying that if energy and matter are related together, then they should be governed by the one law, and it's called the conservation of matter and energy. So if you count, what it, does it say? If you count the matter and energy which you have before the reaction and the matter and energy which you have after the reaction, you should have the equal numbers. It was the first shock actually to the atheist when they realized that matter can be changed to energy. And the important thing is to realize that energy doesn't have gravitational doesn't feel gravity, you know, while the matter is the subject of the gravity. So if we measure mass, we have something which has some weight. But if we measure energy, we measure it in other units which are not related to the mass, but we can convert them actually to the mass. And the philosophical difficulty was in the very claim that something material can be changed to something which doesn't weigh anything and has, in effect, doesn't have a material origin or material characteristics, because it doesn't have the gravitational it's not subject to the gravitational law. The theory of relativity has even more confused the picture when it was formulated by Einstein that if you have a rocket which moves with the velocity v, and if you measure that how much weight that rocket or the stone, let us speak better about stone, because a rocket, when the gases are flashing out, the mass is decreased, but when you have a stone or a bullet, and if you measure it when it is stationary, then you call that mass m0, because it is at zero velocity. But when it starts to move with the velocity described by the letter v, then what you will measure is that it is much heavier, because this multiplicating factor will make it larger and larger. You see, as v approaches velocity of light, it becomes equal to 1. And then 1 minus 1 is 0. But this 1 is, I hope you are acquainted with elementary mathematics. This to minus 1 half means that it is square root of this bracket in the denominator. So if something in denominator is approaching zero, the whole ratio is approaching infinity. So when the speed of body approaches the speed of light, this becomes zero, and m divided by very very small number gives you a very very large result. So that was the result about the mass. The other was about the time, and it looks very similar to this equation, except that we do not have this sign minus here in the exponent, only it is the square root of this bracket. And when something happens at a time which is when it is stationary, then this is the time described by this t0. And when the clock is thrown away with the velocity of approaching the light, then this approaches zero, which means the result is very small. So we have two results. One is that bodies moving with very high velocity approaching the speed of light are very heavy. They are much heavier than if they are stationary. And the time, if you measure on them, is much shorter, or is much longer. The time is much shorter than it. Yeah. So these were the contradictions, and which actually moved the philosophers of atheism to think how it is possible that the matter, which is the basic claim of the materialism actually, is not constant. So can it be changed? Can it be increased or decreased? Yes, there are examples that they can be, and even the time can be. The other shock came when the more experiments has been done, and the first elementary particles has been discovered, like electron and proton, and the experiments which were been done with these elementary particles has shown up that sometimes in some experiments they behave like little bullets, like particles, and in other experiments they behave like waves, because they can interfere and they can make interference patterns. For instance, the light is also made of photons, which are the elementary particles of the light. And if you look sometime on a thin film of oil on the water, you can see the interference pattern that you see the different colors there. They are made because of the interference. If the light would be particles, then that interference, this light pattern, we will not see there. But since they can behave like waves, then they can show these interference patterns, the colors. And there were two schools of physics. One claimed that all the elementary particles are really particles. The other said, mainly the French school, was saying that it is not the particles, it is the waves. And they were arguing together, how can the elementary particle be at the same time the wave and at the same time and particle, until they have discovered, and it was the work of Niels Bohr and his school, that the fact that we do not understand how it is possible should not prevent us from accepting it, that it is so. So nowadays we believe that elementary particles has a dual so-called dual nature. In some experiments they show themselves as particles, in the other experiments they show themselves as the waves. Even this was formulated as a philosophical principle of complementarity, that if we will have only one picture, we will not know the whole truth. And if we will have only the picture of waves, again, we will not know the whole truth. So we need to combine those pictures, which are contradictory, but accept them in order to know the whole truth about the nature of those elementary particles. So this is the principle of complementarity. And actually, it has a, I think, also very strong theological appeal, because we, for instance, as Christians, we believe that God is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And how can God be the Son at the same time? And how can they both be the Holy Spirit? So we know something of God when we have experience with the Holy Spirit. We know something of God when we have experience with Jesus Christ. And we know something of God as we have experience with the Father. And all those pictures together, by the principle of complementarity, give us the full knowledge of God. So why actually those laws has been formulated? It was, as I mentioned, that the measurements have shown that if you measure the amount of energy and matter before the reaction, it is the same as after the reaction. But the measurements which has been done in that time were not very precise. We didn't have such an equipment to measure it more precisely than as we have today. For instance, the mass, people were able to measure up to few milligrams, which is 10 to the minus 5 of kilogram. But today we are able to measure mass equals to minus 10 to the minus 30 of kilogram. So if you 10 to the minus 30 is the number which has 1 in the denominator, and in the denominator you have 1 with 30 zeros after it. So if it would be 10 to minus 1, it is 1/10. 10 to minus 2 is 1/100. So this is very, very, very much improvement of the measurement. Also, the time we were able 100 years ago to measure up to the milliseconds, but now we are able to measure time to 10 to the minus 4th of seconds. So it's billions of billions of billions of seconds. So they are very, very short time. And what is surprising is that when we observe events which occur in the nature and which last very, very small time, 10 to the minus 20 of second, then if we measure what is in the beginning of the reaction and what is in the going out, we do not find the agreement. And so it was another shock for materialistic philosophy. How it is possible that the laws of conservation do not work? First, people thought that it is mistake by the measurement, but then it was really found out that the measurements were right, and even there was a theoretical proof that it should be in this way, which was derived from quantum mechanics by a physicist called Heisenberg. And I wrote this principle here. Again, I will explain what does it mean. this number here is so-called Planck constant, h, is divided by 2p. What is important is that this is the very small number. This is a very small number. And this, you have here the factor of two elements. One is our knowledge of energy, or the uncertainty of how we can determine energy in the process, and our measurement has the uncertainty of the time in which it is, which this reaction was going on. So it says that if we measure 100% or with very big precision energy, then in order that this is very small number, in order that the result will be small number, this number must, even if this number is large, if this number is small, then we still have a result equal small number. So you can put it also the other way, divide the both sides on the delta t, and you will see that the uncertainty in energy is equal this constant divided by uncertainty in time. So if we measure very precisely the time during the reaction, we can say nothing of the energy which is involved. And if we measure very precisely the energy which is involved, we do nothing about the time for the reaction. And the similar equation holds also not only for energy and time, but also for velocity and the position. And this is more it can be explained more naturally, that there are uncertainties in our measurement. For instance, if you want to measure the speed of the car, you have to measure it at one position. You make the use the clock, and then at the other position you measure the time for which that trajectory was passed by this time. And if you divide the trajectory by time, you have velocity. So, but there is uncertainty because you must have two times, time t1 and time t2, at the beginning and the end, in order to determine the velocity, and you must have two positions. So the both time and the position are uncertain because the car during the experiment was moving from one place to the other place. So it could have been somewhere in between during the measurement. And so if you would measure well, I think I will not elaborate it on this much longer, but what is important is to know that from the quantum mechanics itself, there are limitations of our knowledge of the energy and of time and of the velocity and of the position of the elementary particles which goes into the reaction which we are studying. Epistemological consequence is that there are limits to our knowledge a priori given by the quantum mechanics, because if we measure one of these time or position very precisely, we can say nothing about the others, energy or the velocity, or the vice versa. So is that only theory or is it reality? Well, in studying elementary particles, we have found that there are really in the nature the processes where the matter disappears and is changed to energy completely without any rest. If you burn coal, then you have ashes and you have carbon dioxide at the end. But if you make a reaction of electron and positron, which is the antiparticle to the electron, they can completely annihilate each other, and what you have is just the flash of light, which is described there as two gamma rays. Actually, this is very, very interesting reaction, because this reaction is now exploited in the so-called electron-positron tomography in the hospitals, that you have a patient who is getting some medicine which is radiating positrons, and if this say this medicine contains iodine, then if this iodine is absorbed in tissues, in some of the tissues, like in these glands, you know, or in cancer tissues, then when this positron is released, that it meets the first electron, which is around the nearest atom, and it annihilates, and the two gammas, two flashes of lights are going opposite to each other. And if you have several such events, then one is this way and the other one is that way, you can precisely identify the place where is the tissue which needs to be treated, located. So this is actually a reaction which is very well known, and even it is exploited, as I said, in the hospitals today. So this is a reaction where something at the beginning, you have something which has the weight, but at the end you have only light, which is weighting nothing. So there are also reactions which are going the other way, where you have two lights from laser, for instance, and when they smash each other, what you find out is the electron and positron going out. So at the beginning, you had only something which doesn't weigh anything, which is the zero rest mass, but at the end, you have particles which you can weigh, which are really massive particles. And there are reactions where the light can be changed to many, many other particles. And so there are really experiments where we can measure that, and we can show that the matter and energy are interrelated by this Einstein relation, and that energy can be changed to matter and matter can be changed to energy. But what was the very important thing was that when we improved our measurements and found out that at these very short times the conservation of energy doesn't hold, it gave explanation to another physical theory or physical reality which people didn't understand, and it was the expanding universe. It was found out that the universe is expanding at certain velocity, and that velocity is increased with the objects which are further from, if they are further on, they move away from us with larger velocity than those which are closer. So the whole picture resembles an explosion where you have something exploding, and those particles which are slow, they are still near to the explosion place, but those which had the very big velocity, they are thrown far away, and they are quite far and moving much faster than those which are close to. And this gave the theory the explanation to the how to understand the universe is expanding. And you see, the ITT claim was that the universe is stable, doesn't change. It is from infinity to minus infinity to plus infinity, and Already in that time, it was known, the second law of thermodynamics, of which we have heard today quite a lot in previous lectures, which says that if something lasts for a very long time, then the temperature in that closed system becomes equal in all parts of this system. In other words, that the hot objects will become cooler, and those which were very cool become a little bit hotter until the temperature is leveled up. So if the universe would exist from the minus infinity, then it would already be cooled down to very, very low temperature, and life would not be possible. But there were still some excuses to take consequently this second law of thermodynamics. But when the Big Bang theory entered the picture, it completely changed the understanding of the universe, because the second law of thermodynamics applies only to the systems which are closed, where no matter can be added, no energy can be added, or can be taken out. It must be isolated system. But the universe, as we see it now, is not or doesn't need to be closed, because the matter can change to energy, and energy can change to matter. And moreover, it was found out that the matter can be created from vacuum. In order to explain what does it mean that the matter can be created from vacuum. You know, vacuum is something, an empty space. It's nothing. Yeah. And this was our understanding of the vacuum until maybe 20 years ago, when the theory of quarks was developed, and it was found out that elementary particles, which I have mentioned, electron, positron, and proton, and then you have neutron, and you have mesons, and they were discovered more and more particles in these big accelerators, like you have in the United States in Fermilab, for instance, or in Europe we have such an accelerator at CERN near Geneva. So they are already about 300 elementary particles known. So people said, how they could be elementary if there are so many? There should be some inner structure of those particles, which we do not understand exactly, because they behave like waves and like particles as well. But anyhow, they should have some deeper structure. And this deeper structure was assigned to the existence of quarks. And now we understand vacuum in quantum theory in such a way that the vacuum is full of virtual particles, which we do not see, but they are there. Like if theology has claimed that there are many angels around us, but we do not see them. It's something similar, but this is the sound scientific claim, what I am saying. It's not something, it's the consequences of the theoretical explanations of the measured data which exists. And it says that energy and matter can burst out from vacuum and come to the existence in the space and time. And this is actually one of the explanations of the beginning of the universe, that the matter and energy has burst out from the vacuum and in one singularity, and the whole explosion has started, and the universe was created. So talking about quarks, and also of elementary particles, there is one very interesting thing of them, that they are so small and so tiny that we do not see them. It is impossible to see them by some microscope, because they are so tiny, so small. But still we can observe them. And how can we observe them? Then the way how we can observe those particles which we do not see is similar how we can observe the plane flying very high in the atmosphere, leaving the white path of steam behind the engines. If there are good conditions in atmosphere, you may not see the plane, but you see the track where the plane was going on, because it left the white strip behind it. So the same actually thing is used to know about the elementary particles, about the matter, that we know these of their existence, of their qualities, of their electric charge, of their mass, and of their other quantum characteristics of those particles by the interaction with the rest of the surroundings. And so in this way we can know that even we didn't see them, they were there, and they were passing through our apparatus and left the signal there. Again, the analogy, the God is invisible, and we do not know the God. We cannot examine God with our eyes. We cannot make a visual experiment with God, but we can know of Him in spite of the fact that He is invisible. If we can know of the matter, of elementary particles which are invisible through their interaction with the matter, we can know of God through the interaction with His universe, which He created, and through the interaction with the mankind, which He created, through the history of mankind. And this is the way how the revelation, truth of revelation and truth of God revealed in the nature somehow make the complete picture. It's natural that invisible God will leave the world, will create something of which will describe His own characteristics like as an invisible one. If we have a painter and he paints the picture, we can infer from looking at the picture whether he was, what he was sort of a man. If we read the book, then we can infer from what we read of the writer, what was his values, what was his thinking, who he was. We do not know him precisely because we know him only when we meet him. But reading his book, we can know something of him. So, every creator who, in our earthly experience, every man who creates and woman creates something, he leaves part of his intelligence in what he has created. So also the God has left his fingerprints in material world, and that he is invisible. I would be very surprised if the matter would be visible. I mean, we can see the atoms and molecules if they are in a big large lamps of and make living bodies or make molecules of iron on or the other materials, wood and so on. But when we come to the very nature of the matter, we come to those particles which are in principle invisible. The modern theory of the quarks, which is called quantum chromodynamics, it is the word divined from quantum electrodynamics, because the electrodynamics was the earlier theory which was very well proved by experiments. It shows that those quarks, even for us, will never be visible. In principle, we will not be able to release a single quark out of the particle or out of the vacuum, because as long as we take one of them, we need a tremendous energy for that, which is enough to pull out the other companion, the other quark with him. And if we have already two quarks, they form elementary particle. The elementary particles are composed either of two quarks or three quarks. And the discoveries of last year say that we have been observing the particles which have five quarks, so-called pentaquarks particles. But these already are particles which we can weight and which can measure. But the single quarks, in principle, we cannot. And the theory is explaining or trying to explain how it is possible. So the picture of the world which we have today is not only that we do not understand what is the matter. Let me say the other words. If the atheists tell us, explain us who is God, and we start, well, you know, God is spirit and he is invisible and so on, or they say, oh, we believe only in material things. But what is matter? What is matter which is composed of elements which are in principle invisible and in principle immeasurable? Only when they combine together we can measure them. And we can know of them only because of the interaction with the rest of the world. So this is very similar to what we know of God. And the revelation of God through the scripture and the revelation of God through the nature which I am studying, these elementary particles, is very much alike. There is another puzzle which is last 10 years or maybe less than 10 years, and it is this dark matter and dark energy. Until recently, the astronomers and all the people or scientists believe that the universe is composed of those stars and nebulas which we can observe with the very strong binoculars, with the Hubble telescope going around the Earth and so on. But when they started to calculate the movement of those nebulas, they found out that to explain their movement, if the gravitation law of Newton is still applies there as it applies here, which we believe that it is the universal law which applies in the whole universe, then there must be some missing matter which could explain only that there is some stars which are invisible, or some matter which is not radiating light and therefore we do not see it. My colleagues, very, very many of them, believe that these are elementary particles like neutrinos which are penetrating the whole world, and even here in this room there are milliards and milliards of neutrinos going different ways, and they have the ability to penetrate the whole Earth without stopping. Electron, when you smash the electron and you put the paper, then it will stop it if it is not energetic enough. But the neutrino of the same energy will penetrate through whole walls and even through the whole Earth to the other side. And you can detect it, if you are lucky, with your detection technique to capture it on the other side of the Earth. So almost 90% of the universe is filled up with something which we still do not understand what it is. And therefore we call it the dark energy or dark matter. This dark matter is postulated to explain the gravitational influences which we see on those nebulas very far. And the dark energy is postulated to explain why the universe is expanding. And if it would be just expanding, then we would say that initially it has got some momentum and now it goes on. But the measurements show that the expansion is increasing, that it is expanding with increasing rate of expansion. So to explain that, you need some more energy. And this is called the dark energy. And the estimates show that 90% of our world, which we live in, is composed of dark energy and dark matter, which we do not know what it is. So what are the claims of the atheism that there is only matter and energy, and they don't believe anything else? If we exactly do not know what is the matter, what is the nature, very nature of the energy, And yet we are made of that matter, and we can think, and we can make an experiment with it. Just to claim that there is nothing else, then it's a very short-sighted. The other myth, which, for instance, I was very, very, very moved, was the claim of the Marxism that there are not unknowable things, only the things which are unknown. It is related to the omnipotence of the science, that the science is like the golden cow, which if we bow to it and if we devote enough time to it and enough energy and enough money, then we will discover everything and explain everything. And so it was formulated in this little, very short sentence: there are no unknowable things, only unknown, which are yet unknown, but maybe in future, or sure in future, they will be known by us. And this claim was very, very, very openly shown to be wrong, because the theory of relativity, which was formulated in 1905 by Albert Einstein, has shown out that if there are events in the space and time which are outside of the light, so outside of the cone, which is called the light cone, if you imagine that we are in this position and that the time is going, I could draw the picture. If on this axis we have time, and on this axis we have distance, then if the object starts to move from here, in 1 minute, 1 meter per minute, then he will come to this point. And if it will continue, it will go that way, and it will leave this path. And the similar way, if something has arrived to us with the same speed, it came from the past, from minus t, and so we have this cone here. But if we take the velocity, which is not the small one, but the largest one, which is measured in the universe, and we didn't find any larger velocity than the velocity of the light, then this will be very sharp cone, where all the events which are in this area can influence us, and we can influence all the events which are in this area, but we cannot influence the events which are in this area here, inside the light cone. So the theory of relativity shows us that our knowledge is limited in principle, because the speed of information, the largest speed of information, is speed of light. And if it is not it is limited. It is not equal to how you call in English this if somebody writes number 8, which is just infinity, yeah. So it is not infinite. The velocity is not infinite. The velocity of any information is less than or equal to the velocity of light. So it's not infinite. Therefore, our knowledge is limited. The other thing was the relation of uncertainty coming from theory of relativity, which I have already talked to you about. And Of course, there were also already some limitations of our understanding in the classical mechanics, that if you measure, for instance, how is long this table, if you measure it 10 times with a very precision measurement, then 10 times you will find the different values. But if you make an average, you will find that what you have measured is plus and minus about this average value. So you measure it with a certain uncertainty, which you can calculate if you take the lowest measured value and the largest measured value, then you have the interval, which determines your precision of your measurement. But it was believed that if we will have enough precise instruments, we will decrease that uncertainty to zero. But the theory of quantum mechanics and uncertainty principle show us that in principle this is not possible to shrink it to zero, because there is Planck constant, which is a small number, but there is a limit. And so this also shows us that our knowledge of the world is limited. So what we have actually found out compared to the science of the previous centuries is that we have found out the boundaries of the physical laws. We have not proved that the physical laws, like the law of conservation of matter and energy, doesn't apply. They apply, but at certain circumstances. There are other circumstances when they do not apply. And so we have found a limitation of the validity of the so-called everlasting and ever-truth physical laws. We find out that there are some conditions where they are not applicable, and we have to apply another law. And so this is very nice to see that the science itself came to know its own limitation. You know, Blaise Pascal was one of the first scientists living in the 17th century, who was a very deep devoted Christian, and he said that what is great about man is that he is not God on one side, but he is not nothing on the other side. But being created similar and on the picture of God, man can know his own limitations. And he is not miserable. He is miserable because he is nothing, actually, compared to the universe, for instance. Just a small atom in the whole universe. But because he knows his own limitations, he is great. Because then something of the God's nature is revealed inside in him. So the science today is coming to its own limit, showing that do not be proud of your scientific discoveries and of your science conclusions which you have today, because tomorrow they will be surpassed by another knowledge which will show that the processes are possible which you thought before that they are impossible. Like creation of matter and creation of energy, it was thought it is impossible, therefore the materialism was postulated, while we see that today that it is possible, and the materialism has lost its scientific background. I would like just to conclude that what is the nature of knowledge in science and in belief. I found very nice similarity in what we are doing in science and what we are doing as Christians in our Christian attitude through faith to God. In science, We do not believe today authorities. We do not believe it is so because Newton said that. Because we have seen that Newton has made very good, many good things, but he has made also some mistakes. And we do not believe the scientific explanation works because Richard Feynman has said that. If he said something, we will make an experiment, we will prove, was he right or was he wrong? So our knowledge of truth is based not on the authorities, but is based on our own measurement of our own experience. And if we have an experience, then we formulate hypothesis, and then we make more experiments, and we formulate theory, and then we try to analyze the theory and find the consequences of that theory, and make another experiments to prove that the consequences are really appearing in the nature, and then we say, yes, we have proved the theory. The theory is true. But in our Christian attitude, I think we are behaving like a scientist. Evangelical Christians are really behaving like scientists because our faith is not based on the authority of our father or our mother or of our preacher or of the Pope in the Rome. Our faith is based on experience with Jesus Christ as a living creature. It's mystical, but it is so. But our experience with matter is not less mystical if you imagine that it's invisible. It is mystical, but it is so. And when in the science we say that something is scientifically accepted, that it is the scientific truth, well, it must fulfill several conditions. The one of them is that if I make an experiment and I find some result, and if I repeat the same experiment under the same conditions later on, maybe 1 week later, I should get exactly the same result. I should be able to verify my previous results by doing the same experiment again. So then it means that my experiment must be independent of the time. What I have measured today, I could have improved it also tomorrow. Independence of time. Then the other attribute is that it should be independent of position, of space. If I make the same experiment in Europe or in America, if the conditions are the same, again, the result must be the same. In other words, what has been discovered by scientists in Europe could be proved to be true by scientists in America, because this truth should be independent of space, of position. And the third very important attribute is that it should be objective, that it should not be subjective, but it should be objective. But how, if I measure something, and if I am only who has measured it in the world, how can I claim that I have found the objective truth if it was only my experience? It must be independent of me. It must be independent of the experimenter who has made the experiment. If some other person comes and makes the same experiment as I have did with the same conditions, then he must get the same results. So then it will be say this is objective truth, because it is not based on the experience of one man, but is based on experience of many people who could prove it. And take your Christian experience. Isn't it time invariant? Doesn't depend on time. Isn't it space invariant? Doesn't depend whether you live in America or in Australia. You can have the same experience with the living God. And it's independent of person. If I am the only one who believes in God creating the world, coming to the earth, dying on the cross and raising up from the death, then I might be very, very, very easily mistaken by some. But if we are 10, then it is more objective. But if we are 1,000, it's even more objective. But if you have the whole string of millions of people through the history claiming the same experience, we have trusted him and he has proved himself faithful, then it is objective truth. So the science actually of nowadays is very much teaching us and showing us that what we are doing as Christians, professing as Christians, is not unscientific, it is not mythology, but it is comparable with the very sound action of the sound mind of the what can be imagined actually. So this is I would like to conclude and to leave some few minutes if you have any questions or comments. Yes.
Actually, I have a question. I have heard once about Hillary, which says that actually with the modern elementalities, you can completely forget about the matter and you can speak only about the kind of the energy or something. Is it also, is this still continuing such a line?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
All the analysis of the data, which I am doing, for instance, myself as well, is that we, if we have a massive particle, we use the Einstein equation to turn it to energy, and we work only with the energy as a variable to feed the data and to find out what is going on. So the matter and energy seem to be really the same, and yet one has the one you can measure, this is the typical classical matter, the other one is like the spirit, like the gravitational field. You cannot measure the weight of the gravitational field, but yes, it is there. This is the energy of the gravity is spread around. And so there are many, many other pictures which are helping us to understand the nature of God also. Just mentioning the field theory, people say, how can God be present everywhere at the same time? If you are here, then you cannot be in the other room. But the gravitational field or electromagnetic field or radio waves like electromagnetic field, they are spreading all around at the same time. So we have examples from the material world which we can measure, showing us some or enlightening us some mystery of the nature of God.
But my question, okay, you just mentioned that actually, I mean, in theory, you can use any, let's say, picture or something.
Yes.
But the point is, could you really somehow finish with this complementarity that when you go to the very small particles, that you just completely do not observe any particle kind characteristics, only wave-like characteristics, I mean like energy or something.
No. In the very low, you have both pictures at the same time.
Still.
Every yes.
So not possibility to completely...
No.
And about the post-tomography, something more about the idea, because when you say that, does the iodine somehow accumulate in this part, Krebs, in the cancer, or why you just see differently the cancer and other?
It was found out by pharmacologists that the cancer tissues absorb certain elements in much larger quantities than the healthy tissues.
And this
is used to make those elements radioactive in order to make the visible the place where they accumulate. And it's very, very, very advantageous, because when the surgeon started to do the surgery before, they could damage the whole healthy tissue around. But now they can, with millimeter precision, go exactly to the tumor, you know, and to cure it and to take it out without damaging the surrounding healthy tissues. Mm-hmm. So this is just one application, but the whole theory of elementary particles is very far from applications, except of our understanding, of universe and of our understanding of our own nature and the nature in which we live. But surely there will be many, many applications in maybe 20, 30, 40 years. For instance, particles similar to electrons are muons. They were discovered much later than electrons. And they are much heavier than electrons, and they have also the same charge as electron. And the muons are produced very much in the atmosphere from the cosmic radiation. Everywhere there are hundreds of muons going through our bodies. So the idea is, for instance, to make a big rentgen or a big screen to detect the muons going through the lorry, for instance, the heavy lorry, and you want to know whether they have some drugs or whether they smuggle some uranium or something like that. Then if we will be able to make detectors and put it just underneath of the car, we will see exactly like what is in, you know, using those muons. But there are many ideas of how in future all this knowledge could be used. But I think what is already very valuable is that it opens us the new perspective of thinking, new perspective of grasping the truth. And what is fascinating is that this new perspective is very, it's not contradicting the biblical revelation. It's very supporting to the biblical revelation.